Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. The right of everyday citizens to have firearms goes back to before our nation's founding, a controversial idea in the dictatorial age of kings. The controversy remains intensely alive today, with battle lines sharpened after the elementary school massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, and the subsequent defeat in the United States Senate of requiring background checks for all gun purchases. On one end of the debate are those who feel that almost any restriction of firearms access is an infringement of the Second Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. On the other, people who believe the amendment was intended to assure state militias, not a personal right to ownership. Then there are those in the middle who support the right to ownership, but also want some gun control regulations. Professor of Constitutional Law Adam Winkler has written a book about all this. Titled Gunfight, it has some surprises for just about everyone. Adam Winkler, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a little about your background. What did your folks do? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in a Hollywood family. My father is a motion picture director and producer for many, many years, made a lot of great movies, including many that your listeners would have seen. So I grew up in the west side of Los Angeles where there were no guns. In fact, my parents had the strictest form of gun control. We weren't even allowed to have water guns back when I was a kid. But as I became a constitutional law professor, I became really interested in this provision of the Constitution that so many law professors ignored, and I wanted to find out what it meant and how should we think about the Second Amendment today.
Now, I'm wondering if the fact that you weren't allowed water pistols sort of stimulated your interest in learning about guns.
It may have. It's hard to say, but I wasn't really interested in guns when I was growing up. You know, we didn't have guns as part of the culture of my community. It was really a matter of constitutional law and trying to figure out what the Constitution means that drove me to inquire into guns.
Well, let me just read the Second Amendment as quoted obviously in your book, a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. You said you were interested in what that meant. How did you go about finding out?
Well, first, I engaged in quite a bit of historical research. I wanted to look back at what did the founders mean when they wrote these words. You know, ever since Madison put that sentence into the Constitution, it's confused generations of Americans. It's almost as if Madison had just discovered this wonderful new thing, the comma, and wanted to put it in there as many times as possible. And so it is confusing. So I looked at a lot of original sources. I went and looked at all the secondary literature. You know, over the past 30 years, there's been an incredible amount of literature on the historical origins of the Second Amendment. So I was able to benefit from the hard work of so many researchers over the last 30 years.
As you start out now, you're a constitutional lawyer. You start looking into this. You read the Second Amendment. What was your initial impression before you did the research?
Sure. Well, I think like many people, when I first read the Second Amendment, I was confused. It seemed to be a right that was related to militia service, and militia service itself was confusing because it doesn't resemble anything that most Americans experience today. At the same time, it does say the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and the language, the right of the people to do something, is used elsewhere in our Bill of Rights to signify an individual right. So I wanted to look into it and come up with my own conclusions about what this amendment meant, and what I concluded was that it was intended and has long been interpreted by the American people to protect an individual right to have guns for self-defense. At the same time, I think that there is a lot of historical precedent and tradition for regulation of guns in the interest of the public, the difficulty is figuring out where to draw the line between permissible regulations and the individual right to bear arms.
We'll talk about that in quite a bit of depth as we go through this discussion. Just as an aside, the kind of rich personal anecdotes you bring into this book that bring it to life would be George Washington had 50 firearms. I didn't know that. Thomas Jefferson got his first rifle at the age of 10. It was terrific to see that sort of thing. You mentioned something in passing that up until the last 40 or 50 years, there hasn't been a lot of legal scholarship on the Second Amendment. Did that surprise you? And historically, what's your explanation for it?
Well, it didn't surprise me that much, only because I knew enough from my early studies. There was a famous article written by a liberal law professor named Sandy Levinson called The Embarrassing Second Amendment. And what was embarrassing about it was that there was so little constitutional scholarship, that so many left-leaning law professors who expressed great interest in an individual right and in liberty against government intrusion really treated the Second Amendment like an unwanted stepchild hidden in the basement without any extensive discussion. And in fact, if you look at every major constitutional law textbook, you won't find any mention of the Second Amendment until about 10 years ago. And why that is, I think in part that is maybe in the story of the demographics of the law professoriate a little bit. But I think it was also a matter of the American people for most of the 20th century were not very focused on gun rights. There was more attention paid to gun regulation, in part because we didn't have much gun regulation, and we had a huge surge in crime in around the mid-century. So I think the historical literature was in part responding to shifts in the larger movement of gun rights, and that the scholarship really followed the advocacy here rather than being the font of the advocacy.
I'm going to go through some things I've found, and your book is fascinating to me, and I am a gun person. I have I have a fair number of firearms in our family. They're all well cared for and well used for hunting. And I found it just highly interesting historically and in terms of both sides of the argument that you just summarized. But I picked out some things that are worth, I think, exploring a little bit. You say, to lower the risk of rebellion, King James, this is in the 1600s, decided to take advantage of laws passed before his reign to confiscate as many guns from potential dissidents as he could. The Militia Act of 1664 authorized the king's deputy to seize the weapons of anyone deemed to be, quote, dangerous to the peace of the kingdom, end quote. Tell us about how that sort of experience may or may not have influenced the thinking of the founders as they approached this question.
Well, we have to think of the founders in their own time. You know, when you're writing a constitution in the 1700s, what were they concerned about? What was driving them and motivating them to write this constitution? And one of the things that they were almost certainly motivated by was the memory of repression of Englishmen by tyrannical monarchs. And not just George III imposing his will on the colonies, but back in the 1600s with James and some of the other kings that ran roughshod over the liberties of the people. And after James was deposed and a new king and queen brought in, William and Mary, they were forced to agree to what's known as the English Bill of Rights that had a provision respecting and guaranteeing the right of at least Protestants to have guns suitable to their conditions and as allowed by law. And
did you say Protestants?
That's right. At the time, it was a religiously based distinction. Catholics were thought to be dangerous to the peace of England. As you know, that England has had great debates over the role of the Roman Catholic Church in government ever since Henry VIII broke from the church. And one of James's problems was that he was a Catholic, and people thought the Catholics were going to try to take over the country and return it to the power of the Pope. And so the right was guaranteed only to Protestants, but the larger point was that the English forefathers of our forefathers had a Bill of Rights that protected the right of people to have access to arms for personal protection and otherwise. And the founders very self-consciously modeled their own Bill of Rights after the one they had experience with in England.
A little further on, when you discuss the Revolutionary Era and the Founders' Era, you write this: in the Revolutionary Era, gun laws were strict, .. with national defense becoming too important to leave to individual choice or the free market, the founders implemented laws that required all free men between the ages of 18 and 45 to outfit themselves with a musket, rifle, or other firearm suitable for military service. And all muskets, it says, at the musters, government officials would inspect people's guns and account for the firearms on public rolls, an early version of gun registration. I was quite surprised to read that. Did it surprise you?
Absolutely. You know, the Founding Fathers strongly believed that individuals should have the right to bear arms and wrote the Second Amendment to secure that right. Yet they also had gun regulations. Not only did they bar large portions of the population from possessing guns, including slaves and free blacks, and even white men who opposed the Revolution, but they also had these severe militia laws that required gun owners to appear at public gatherings where their guns would be inspected and even registered on state rolls. You might think of that perhaps as the forefathers' version of the individual mandate. People had to go out and outfit themselves with a firearm. And what was surprising was that the Founding Fathers believed in a right to bear arms, but it wasn't really the libertarian version of the right to bear arms that we often think of today, a version that was immune from state regulation. The Founding Fathers really believed in a well-regulated body of citizens who would own guns and be prepared to defend the nation in an instant.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about gun rights in America with Professor of Constitutional Law, Adam Winkler. You mentioned that in England, there was a religious line between access to firearms. And in the United States, the excerpt I just read from your book discussed free men. Obviously, slaves were not entitled to firearms. I want to read another thing from your book on page 133. Blacks, however, were not, quote, citizens, end quote, certainly not in the view of Roger Taney. In 1857, Taney, the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, wrote the opinion for the court in the infamous case of Dred Scott versus Sanford. Blacks, he said, quote, were unfit to associate with the white race, end quote, and, quote, had no rights which the white man was bound to respect, end quote. What did your research show in relation to gun rights as it was affected by racial prejudice in America over time?
Well, one thing that Gunfight really tries to do is trace the many ways in which race and racism has influenced the story of guns in America. Some of America's earliest gun control laws were racially discriminatory, as you mentioned. And indeed, the KKK began as a gun control organization in some ways. During the Civil War, blacks in the South got their hands on guns for the very first time, and racist whites formed posses like the KKK to go out at night and confiscate those guns from the freedmen. If blacks were disarmed, the idea was they wouldn't be able to fight back as whites tried to reestablish their supremacy. And that continues really up until, as I'm sure we'll talk about later, the modern era in the 1960s and the Black Panthers. But Roger Taney was someone who wanted to deny blacks their rights, and he thought that if blacks were citizens, they would, he said, have the right to keep and carry guns wherever they went. They'd be entitled to the Second Amendment. And for the white racist, that was an intolerable position.
Now, am I understanding you correctly to say that the Dred Scott decision, or Taney himself, the Scott decision having legal precedent, said that blacks were not citizens, even free blacks, with full rights?
That's right. And that was what was so disturbing about that decision. There were other aspects of Dred Scott that were disturbing as well, but that's why Dred Scott has gone down in history as one of the most infamous and notorious decisions of the Supreme Court. It was a terrible failure. It did not make a compromise that Roger Taney was hoping over the issues of slavery in the territories, and indeed just tended to exacerbate the tensions that led to the Civil War.
One final thing I'd like to read from the book, because it was jarring to me as a citizen of the rural West, where we take the idea of guns and lack of government regulations in general, and perhaps of firearms in specifics, as part of our cultural heritage. This is from page 165. A grainy black and white photograph of Dodge City, taken around 1879, shows a huge wooden billboard posted in the middle of the main road through the town that states, quote, "The carrying of firearms strictly prohibited. The visitors were welcome, but their guns were not." I was amazed to see that gun control was part of the Western town culture.
Well, we all have this image ingrained in our mind, the gunslinger walking through the Wild West town, six shooters on each hip, a rifle in each hand, and a duel on Main Street every day at high noon. But one of the remarkable things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that our popular understanding of the Wild West couldn't be more inaccurate. The frontier towns, places like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, they had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. Everyone out in the Wild West had guns, especially out in the untamed wilderness. But when you came into a town where the civilized folk lived, you had to check your guns like you'd check your coat at a restaurant in the winter. And indeed, when residents of Dodge City formed their municipal government, do you know the very first law they passed was a gun control law? And these towns had very little gun violence, actually. We think of these Wild West shootouts happening all the time, but these towns in the Wild West period, roughly 1870 to 1890, averaged less than 2 murders a year.
You mentioned earlier when I asked you about the lack of historical scholarship into the Second Amendment, perhaps a left-wing bias among the professors that were doing the research. I was a student in California during the era of the Black Panthers, and you write somewhat extensively about the Black Panthers, which would be considered a left-wing group, certainly on a political spectrum. Tell us about guns and the Panthers and that whole issue.
Well, one of the most amazing spectacles in the history of guns in America was the day in May 1967 when 30 members of the Black Panthers marched right into the California Capitol building in Sacramento, openly carrying loaded rifles, pistols, and shotguns. They weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law. Conservatives in California were seeking to disarm the Panthers. And in fact, the late 60s saw a number of gun control laws enacted to restrict access to guns by blacks. Ironically, some of these same laws helped fuel the rise of the modern gun rights movement as more and more people thought the government was coming to get their guns next. It's ironic that laws designed to disarm black urban left-leaning radicals like the Black Panthers sparked a backlash among white, rural, and often politically conservative people who were concerned that the government was coming to get their guns next.
Let's talk about the Heller case, the case that this, where the United States Supreme Court recently ruled on these basic questions, both in terms of the individual right and the ability of government to potentially regulate. Tell us about Heller.
Well, the book really revolves around this amazing lawsuit, District of Columbia against Heller. And it was a lawsuit brought by not the NRA and the ordinary usual players in the gun debate, but by a trio of libertarian lawyers who were inspired by a ruling of a lower court saying that the Second Amendment should be read to protect an individual right to bear arms. And they pursued this lawsuit, a very sort of strategic lawsuit, inspired by the NAACP and the Legal Defense Fund's efforts in the civil rights movement, where they strategically recruited ideal law-abiding plaintiffs with the specific goal of challenging D.C.'s restrictive ban on handguns in hopes of stimulating the Supreme Court to step in and clarify the meaning of the Second Amendment. The young lawyer who headed up the litigation was named Alan Gura. He's become sort of a hero in the gun rights movement, but yet he didn't have much experience, and the lawyers put a lot of faith in him, and he went up against some of the heaviest hitters in the law, some of the best, most experienced Supreme Court advocates, and even though he had never before made an argument at the Supreme Court, and even before this case had never even argued at a court of appeals, he made an astounding argument, won a remarkable victory for gun rights, and helped the Supreme Court finally to declare that the Second Amendment clearly and unambiguously protects the right of individuals to have guns.
Tell us about Alan Gura. I was really amazed in reading this guy had was a sole practitioner, I think, didn't even have a legal secretary or something. He takes on the whole legal system. In fact, the NRA, if I remember from reading your book, was initially opposed to the lawsuit and didn't want him taking the case because he was not a well-known lawyer. Did you get to know him? What kind of guy is he?
I did get the chance to know him. I interviewed him several times for the preparation of the book. I was able to visit his home and meet his family. He's really a very nice young guy. He's a young libertarian. He calls himself a guns and drugs libertarian. He's not into guns or drugs, but he thinks government has no business regulating either of them. And he believed in the cause and was willing to work for subsistence wages. The lawyers involved had thought about hiring some of the best experts on guns, like Steve Holbrook. But they decided instead to go with young Gura because he basically would charge nothing. And, you know, some of the other lawyers were really pressured to replace Alan Gura with a Supreme Court heavyweight when the case made it to the Supreme Court, like Ted Olson or Ken Starr. But Robert Levy, who's one of the guy who's financing the lawsuit, really had promised that Gura would have this case to the end. And as a result, he got the chance to make this argument before the Supreme Court. And one of the surprising things that happened along the way was the opposition of the NRA. At nearly every turn, the NRA tried to scuttle this lawsuit. And part of it might have been a little bit of turf battles. The NRA wanted to protect this turf for itself. But interestingly enough, the NRA was not really interested in bringing a case about the Second Amendment to the Supreme Court. Perhaps they were fearful what might happen before the justices and didn't want their view of the Second Amendment as protecting an individual right rejected by this Supreme Court.
Meaning potentially too high stakes. Why push the issue to the court when you might lose?
That's right. And Gura's attitude was that a case is going to go to the Supreme Court anyway. And the question is only whether it's going to be a case that people who have the best interests of the Second Amendment at heart organize and manage, or will this be a case of some gangbanger who's brought up on criminal charges and makes a case that ends up getting to the Supreme Court with a very unsympathetic plaintiff? You know, there had been plenty of gun cases and desperate appeals alleging Second Amendment rights that the Supreme Court could have ruled on over the years. But, you know, United States against crackhead is not a really promising venue for establishing and recognizing individual rights. So it was important to Gura that this be a managed, strategic lawsuit rather than we just wait and see what happens when some criminal brings a case to the Supreme Court.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about gun rights in America with Professor of Constitutional Law Adam Winkler. You said the law in Washington that was taken under the Heller case was restrictive. Can you explain exactly, or in simple terms, what was the law that was being challenged?
Washington, D.C. simply had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. Back in the 1970s, Washington, D.C. was one of a handful of places, along with Chicago and some of those outlying suburbs, that completely banned civilians from owning handguns, with some exceptions, obviously, for security personnel and police officers and whatnot. The law in D.C. also went further. It also effectively barred the use of a long gun, a shotgun or a rifle, for self-defense. You could own a shotgun or a rifle, but you had to keep it locked or disassembled. And you were only allowed to unlock it or assemble it for specified recreational purposes under the law. And a court had even said that if a criminal's breaking through your window and is going to do violence to you, using that gun in self-defense is not a recreational use of the firearm. It's not a game or a sport, and as a result, was illegal. So all you could do with your rifle, if you had one in D.C. and a criminal's coming through your window, is perhaps you could hit him over the head with it on the butt end. But other than that, you couldn't use a gun for self-defense. So it really was a very restrictive gun law.
Yeah, I guess that wouldn't fly too well in our part of the country. So who was the plaintiff?
Alan Gura recruited an amazing group of plaintiffs, mostly people in the Washington, D.C. area, residents of Washington, D.C., for instance, who were just very well respected in their communities or had especially powerful arguments for why they should have guns. One woman was named Shelley Parker, and she was sort of a one-woman wrecking crew in her neighborhood where she tried to disrupt all the drug dealing that was going on in her bad neck of Washington, D.C. And she was threatened by these drug dealers, but she wouldn't stop. She wanted to get these drug dealers out of the community. And they threatened her life. And this is one of these women who, even if you're a liberal who hates guns, you're going to buy this woman a gun first chance you get so that she can protect herself from these criminals out there on the street. And that was one of the brilliant things that Alan Gura did, was to get very sympathetic, ideal, law-abiding plaintiffs to challenge D.C.'s gun laws.
Okay, the case goes to the Supreme Court. What's the decision?
Well, the Supreme Court issues a very strong opinion making clear that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to bear arms. The court dismissed arguments that it was only about protecting militias. The court said that the militias at the time of the framing were made up of we the people, ordinary people called to serve, and that so when the right is guaranteed to the militia, that is not a limitation, but a guarantee of law-abiding people's right to have firearms. At the same time, the court went out of its way to make clear that there's still plenty of room for gun control under the Second Amendment. The court said that nothing in the opinion should cast doubt on laws banning felons or the mentally ill from having guns, or laws banning guns in sensitive places like government buildings or schools. And as a result of the Heller case, there's been a huge tidal wave of litigation over gun regulations. Although the vast majority of gun regulations have been upheld, the big question that the court left unanswered was whether the Second Amendment extends outside of the home and whether it creates a right to have and carry guns in public, and perhaps even more importantly, what kinds of permitting can states impose on those who want to carry guns in public.
One of the things you discussed at some length in your book is it was a 5-4 vote, correct?
That's right.
Okay. One of the things you discussed, Scalia wrote the opinion, Justice Antonin Scalia, who has prided himself for decades on being a quote-unquote originalist. In layman's language to me, that means that you're supposed to interpret the words of the Constitution as the founders intended in the context of their time. You argue he didn't do that in this case.
Well, if you read the Heller opinion, it looks like a triumph of originalism. And indeed, after the decision came down, its many uses of history to explicate the meaning of so many different words and clauses in the Second Amendment was hailed by commentators both left and right as a tremendous example of originalism. But as more experts began to look closely at the opinion, began to see some important inconsistencies. The court does look at history when saying that the right protected is an individual right. But then the court goes off and says, and seeming irregardless of the original intention of the framers, that a whole bunch of different kinds of gun control laws are constitutionally permissible. I mentioned earlier bans on felons having guns or the mentally ill having guns, or bans on guns in sensitive places like government and government buildings and schools. The founding fathers had gun control laws, but they had no gun control laws that were equivalent or that you could draw an analogy to the ones that were listed in Justice Scalia's opinion. And indeed, one of the reasons the court says that machine guns are not protected but handguns are is because handguns are commonly used and chosen by Americans for self-defense. But part of the reason why that is the case is because we've heavily regulated machine guns for a long, long time in this country. When modern-day regulation shapes the right, that's not originalism. That's more like living constitutionalism, the Constitution evolving to fit current day needs and norms.
Which is what Justice Scalia constantly argues with Justice Breyer about, Breyer being a living constitutionalist.
That's right. And at least in this case, Scalia perhaps wasn't as consistent with his originalism as he might be.
Back to the basic issue. We have this highly polarized argument in the nation, and it's really one side versus another. Do you see, as a result of your research, not just into the law, but the kind of people involved, any room for common ground as we go forward looking at this fundamental issue?
I think there is room for common ground, probably not in the short term. It's just too much of a hot button issue. But in the long run, I do think so, because I think the vast majority of Americans agree that individuals should have a right to bear arms, and that the idea of banning all guns is really very far-fetched in America. It's just never going to happen. It's not politically realistic. At the same time, a lot of Americans believe, and including a lot of gun owners believe, that we can do more to keep guns out of the hands of the mentally ill and felons. And I think that that will provide some common ground in the future. But I think right now, nerves are still too raw in the gun debate, so we're not likely to see any compromise in the next few years at least.
Adam Winkler, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground, and I want to thank you personally for writing a very thought-provoking and informative book on an issue of importance to people in our part of the country. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.